General Ralph Younger, Reel 2.
Now, in 1935, you went to Abbasia with the regiment. Could you, before we go back to mechanization, compare the sort of training and life in Egypt at Abbasia with your experiences in England, you know, the kinds of things we talked about in respect of cavalry life and training in England. I'm interested in how it compared in Egypt.
Well, with regard to Egypt, the climate was different to begin with, and your day was different. I mean, always did something before breakfast. I went for a ride, or right in the barrack area. I was probably training some man with a peloponne or something of that sort. And then after that, it was stables as usual, cleaning tack and so on. I think the day was really finished pretty well by lunchtime, in the first few months anyway. But I can't say a great deal about it, because after 3 months I was removed to do a job for 3 months when they sent a small force out to the desert. I think I told you that last time.
Yes, and I'd like to ask you about that again. But just sticking with the routine cavalry life in Egypt, from the training point of view, was it comparable?
The what point of view?
From the training point of view, was it comparable with the training pattern in England?
Yes, it was. We didn't ever get very far from barracks because there were no manoeuvres during that period, as far as I can remember. Well, you see, I think the whole cavalry brigade was in process of being mechanised, or about to be. The 8th Hussars, in fact, lost their horses and got cars to go out for this force after we'd been in Egypt two or three months. And they were next door regiment to us.
What about the social side of life in Egypt? You've already said that you couldn't hunt in Egypt. There weren't, I suppose, many families in the area who might invite young officers to tea and to parties.
Well, there was a winter season, you see, in Cairo. A lot of people used to come out from England. In fact, I first met my wife in Cairo. She came out with her mother. She had a brother in the 11th Hussars. That's when I first met her. And there was a very big social life in Cairo. There was a lot of entertaining. People were very kind. The British colony, it was a large British colony. And from the ambassador downwards, it was a big. It was a pretty hectic social life, the winter period. And then the summer, it all died away.
When did the season begin and end, and what were its main features?
Well, I suppose it began in about October, and increased in intensity to about March, and then the leave season started, and people didn't go, people went home. It was like India. People who were permanent established in Egypt used to go home for the summer, anyway, part of the time. If they didn't go, their wives certainly did, and families, until the war came, and they couldn't. And they found it was quite all right to stay.
And what were the main events and features of the season? How did you meet your wife, for example? Well, that must have been a feature.
there was a lot of duck shooting in Egypt. That was the sport, that really, the main sport of the world. There was a lot of polo, of course, too. We played polo 3 times a week. And Sunday was a great duck shooting day, I think. And there was racing in Cairo, too, rather indifferent racing. We mainly Arab horses, or what they call country bred, which were bred in Egypt. Games, a lot of games, of course. Cricket in the hot weather, football and hockey, and the same games we want to play at home on sand grounds. Cricket was played on a mat.
Balls, dances, were these common?
What?
Balls and dances, were these common?
Yes. A good many of them, small, mainly small. But there were some very rich people in Cairo in the business world, and quite but some people, there was a great deal of entertaining.
Yes,
I think in the British colony.
I believe the nightclub life in Cairo during those years had a great reputation.
Oh yes, there were. I've forgotten the names of all the places now. with nightclubs. But there were, yes, it was a very hectic night. A very hectic, very late nightlife.
Yes. Did you have any favourite clubs?
I didn't really take much part in it, I don't think. I don't know why. Well, for that winter, I was, I spent half of it in the desert. And that would have been nice. I don't think I can remember the names. I just, my wife would remember them, but I don't remember the names.
Okay. Okay.
The Continental Hotel and Shepherd's Hotel, they were the great places. There were a lot of dancing and parties went on there. They were two big hotels. And the Semiramis in Cairo.
Yes. Did you get international stars out there?
Mm.
Now, the regiment finally began to be mechanized in May of 1936.
Well, that was when we got a decision in April or May. I again wasn't there. I was on leave, and there were two leave periods, and I had the first one, April, yes. May, and June. And I arrived to find it in full swing, and I'm not quite sure how soon it started.
Yes.
I arrived back in July.
Yes. So the announcement was made in May, and the actual process also began very shortly after. Was there not any prior notice, any longer notice than that, just a few week period?
I think the commanding officer knew, but he didn't tell anybody. Brigadier knew, but he was told to keep it quiet. The commanding officer, and he did keep it quiet. I mean, I wasn't senior enough to be in his confidence. I wasn't his adjutant, for instance, or one of the squadron leaders then. But as far as I know, nobody was told.
It must have been a bit of a bombshell then.
Well, it was, yes. It was, because it did alter the whole one's way of life. It was vital.
Are there any particular stories you recall, perhaps of some of your contemporaries who took the announcement worse?
I'm just trying to think. I find that very difficult, I'm afraid. I'm not trying to conceal anything, I just find it very difficult.
Now, you missed the first few weeks of the mechanisation phase by getting this posting to Mercer Matru. What sort of job did you have?
I think I was officially called ADC to the brigade commander. In fact, I didn't do much staff work. He had a very improvised staff. I really went about with him, helped to navigate and so forth.
What sort of brigade had been formed and for what reason?
Well, it was formed because the Italians were being tiresome at Saloum. And the 11th Hussars went out there pretty quick, and they always had a squadron at Saloum. And this setup was based on Mercer Matru because it was the only place where there was any water, or much water. And a railway came to there too, as well, in those days. Mm.
That was called the Abyssinian crisis.
Yes, it was. There was certainly a Royal Tank Regiment involved out there, and the 8th Hussars in motor trucks, in trucks, four pickups, and the 11th in their armoured cars. The 8th weren't fully trained by any means. 11th, of course, were as good as ever by then, as they've always been.
It was called the Abyssinian crisis, but did it actually feel like a crisis to you at the time?
No, it didn't. The whole of the Mediterranean fleet was in Alexandria, the whole of the British fleet almost in Alexandria Harbour. That was a magnificent sight, of course. That brought things home to one a bit. But it was fairly obvious after a bit that nothing much was going to happen. Nothing was going to happen. I suppose it was just a preventative thing, this force, and it did some training out there. Training was very limited because of a lack of tank spares, and tracks particularly. And a lot of tracks used to break in the desert a good deal, and that, of course, mobilised the tank.
You went to the brigade having already learned that your own regiment was about to be mechanised, so I imagine
we hadn't been told, but I assumed that it would be.
Oh, you didn't know at all?
No, I didn't know. This was in winter, Christmas 35.
Oh, I see. Yes. When did you got back to the regiment?
About March 36, and went straight away on leave.
When you got back in March 36, mechanization, march it, no, hadn't begun. You went to UK, then you came back to Abbasia
yeah.
in July. When you returned in July and discovered mechanization had already begun...
Well, I knew it had been, of course, somebody had written in Turkey. Whether it was a formal letter or not, I don't remember, but I certainly knew.
How much had been done up to the July period when...
Because of the question of getting rid of the horses. You see, they had to be looked after. Horses had to be fed and exercised. I don't really know where they all went, the horses, I'm afraid. I don't think it went, wasn't a question of being sold locally, I don't think. But where they did go, I don't know. But they'd mostly gone, if not all gone, except the officer's charges, had gone by the time I got back.
When were there, once the bulk of the horses were gone, were there any vestiges of the traditional cavalry life left?
Well, the officers all rode. We had still some, had private, we all had private horses, peloponies, and we owned ourselves, you see. What left part of it was left. Not a great deal else, I don't think. We lived in the same mess and so forth.
So you kept your private horses?
Yes. Our own private horses, yes.
That was a consolation, I'm sure.
Yes, it was. And she went on playing polo.
Now let's deal with the actual process of mechanization and try and detail the kind of things that happened during that period from 1936 up to the outbreak of war. The initial phase was the training of regimental instructors
yes.
in all aspects of mechanization. How was that actually carried out and achieved?
Well, we were... it was mainly done by people, I think it was a six Royal Tank Regiment, I think, was in the brigade. And a Major Culverwell was in charge of this, he was in charge of our instruction. And he, with a team of instructors from his own regiment, and first of all, regimental instructors were trained by his instructors, because they couldn't provide enough instructors to train the whole regiment. Most of it had to be done by regimental instructors. And that took a bit of time.
Weeks, months?
Yes, I should think months rather than weeks. Months, yes. Probably by Christmas, I should think. We'd got enough regimental instructors to do it ourselves. Take it on ourselves. You can't have big squads, you see, training instructors. It simply doesn't get in if you do. They've got to be small squads.
These people who were trained as instructors in the preparatory phase, were they selected or were they volunteers?
They were selected.
Any idea what sort of criteria were used in their selection?
Well, I think education must have come into it, and did come into it. And the ability to instruct. They probably, most of them, instructed in something else already. But there was a good deal of support that they weren't used to absorbing. Mm. And so it had to be really people of some intelligence, NCOs, non-commissioned officers. And officers who perhaps looked as if they might have a bit of a mechanical bent. Mm.
Clearly a Cambridge graduate like yourself was bound to have been
selected. I think I was on the course pretty soon.
Yes. Tell me a bit about the course. First of all, were they RTC officers or NCOs who provided...
No, NCOs. Mm-hmm. Well, I think there was probably one young officer helping Major Culverwell, and I think the rest were NCOs, fairly senior NCOs too. And very nice people they were.
Could you think a little about the training they provided you with and tell me about its various elements?
I think driving and the maintenance and the driving was the first thing we taught. And after that, gunnery and wireless more or less together, because a lot of people knew the Vickers machine gun as it was, anyhow, because we'd had to Our mounted days. Quite a bit of driving we did in the area around Abyssinia, and of course, but much of the works of it, how it worked, was done in classrooms, of course. In classrooms with the various bits of equipment, the training equipment that were available, and on the tanks too, but the principles, I think, were learnt in classrooms.
Were the RTC warrant officers and NCOs who provided this instruction, were they good instructors?
I have a memory of them being particularly high-class chaps, yes. And I'm sure they were specially chosen to do what mightn't, but in fact was quite a reasonably easy job and might well not have been. Hmm.
I wondered if... it's a sort of situation that the cavalry regiments probably, well, as we've already said, regretted it actually arrived, and that element of competition, if you like, between RTC and cavalry, which we've also talked about. I wondered whether there was any sort of sense of, well, you know, at last you cavalry officers have got your comeuppance, and now we're going to teach you what it's really all about.
If it was done, it was all done in a very nice, pleasant, light-hearted way. I don't remember it, actually. Oddly enough, my memories aren't particularly acute of that period.
Yes.
But I was interested in it.
Which of the skills, driving and maintenance, gunnery, wireless, which of these new skills, totally foreign to most of your experience, did you and your contemporaries find the most difficult to absorb?
I think probably the maintenance, not the driving, maintenance, I think I found most difficult. I didn't find wireless at all difficult. I knew the Vickers machine gun already and was interested in it. Mm. I think driving. Not driving, maintenance. And inspecting of tanks.
Talking of the tanks themselves, how quickly and in what sort of numbers did tanks become issued to the regiment?
Well, we didn't have very many to begin with, because they just didn't exist in Egypt. But we had enough to to be enough to train instructors on and do some preliminary driver training and wireless training and so on, but we didn't get our full quantity for some time.
How soon was the regiment able to... this business started, let's say, in the summer of 1936. How quickly was it before the regiment could set up and provide its own courses with this basic nucleus of regimental instructors?
Oh, I should go in 1937.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Yes.
When you came to do that, when you came to that phase, how were the courses you provided organised? Where did you set them up and carry them out? What was the scene?
Well, they were done in squadrons. Initially, it was done under regimental control, but training the first lot of instructors. Once it got done training the soldiers, the squadrons. Squadrons who each had their own instructors trained their own men under the supervision of the squadron leader.
I see. Yes. When the individual training began under the regimental instructors, were there any problems and difficulties? There must have been some. I wondered which ones you recall. Take the period when you were yourself a squadron commander, yeah. and sort of think about that in the transition of the regiment from horses to tanks. Mm. What things seemed to be the most difficult for men to pick up?
Well, I think so. Some people certainly find it a good deal harder to pick up the mechanics than others did, for that was that awful expression, mechanically minded, whether they weren't that or whether they simply they were less intelligent people, I don't really remember. But some people certainly took a good deal longer and never picked it up as well, and some others picked it up extremely quickly. I guess that was partly at least education.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, moving on to the tactical training, at what level did the tactical training begin?
Well, troop. It was a troop of three or four tanks, or three tanks, I think. It was a troop, and that was up to the troop leader to handle them, to move tactically. And various, well, advancing, withdrawing, whatever it might be, the various duties that you had to do them properly in a tidy manner.
Yes.
A tidy and controlled manner.
During those tactical training schemes, were you able to range fairly widely in the area?
Well, you were limited as to the amount of mileage you could use, you see, because of the wear and tear on tanks and the lack of spare tanks. You probably only time you waged mileage when you went out by train to some distant far out in the desert with a major formation, whole formation went and trained there.
Yes.
We had to be frightfully careful about. It was called track mileage, which really wear and tear on the engines as well as on the tracks. And it was a very considerable lack of spares then.
When you reach the formation training stage, the troops training and the squadron training, yeah, and began to work as mechanized forces, were there any problems of communication and control at the early stages?
Oh, yes. There were certain hours at night, particularly, when there was a great deal of interference for climatic reasons, and wireless communication was very, very difficult indeed at night. It was fairly all right in the daytime on speech, but speech or Morse at night, we quite often lost touch for long periods with any considerable distances.
Did that ever lead to any amusing or embarrassing incidents?
Plenty of embarrassing ones.
Give me a few examples.
Well, it's always embarrassing, isn't it, if you're asked to find something out and you can't get through to the chap who could produce the information.
Is there a story that sticks in your mind in this connection?
No, I don't think there is, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. I wish there was. I've been thinking about this.
Right. Now, I think we said that by the autumn of 1937, you had reached the what I've called the combined training stage, that is, training with larger than regimental formations.
Yes, we were beginning with that.
Yes. When you reached the brigade and divisional exercise level, did you personally and your section find these larger formations resulted in correspondingly larger problems?
Well, it certainly there was a very considerable administrative problem. The two things I think I've told you before were petrol and water. I mean, ammunition, if you didn't enter into it, which was always an administrative problem with tanks. But water, for both for drinking water, and if a cooling system in vehicles went wrong, you lost all your everything in the world corresponding to the radiator. That was a problem. We could carry the carriage of water. We didn't have, until about 1943, there wasn't a decent water carrying thing in the British Army. One that didn't break. It was carried about on rough going street. It was just ordinary 2-gallon petrol tins all the water was carried in.
As far as the training, the brigade and divisional training was concerned, did these problems of water and of petrol limit your scope for training exercises?
Yes.
So what then, as a result, what kind of schemes did you practice in your training program? Do you recall them?
Well, I suppose we practiced all the phases of war and much as we could, but I think mainly desert navigation was one thing you see was part of your training, which you had to be pretty good at. And otherwise, it was movement, I think, a controlled movement.
Yes, you said to me last time that in your opinion, wireless communications was the backbone to everything,
yes,
in armoured formations. What did you mean by that exactly?
Well, you couldn't have control without it. control, nor could you get any information or issue orders without it. If your wireless didn't work, nothing worked.
Mm. But I suppose control could militate against mobility.
Well, then you had to... That was, of course, yours. You mustn't sacrifice control and lose speed. It wasn't very easy to get the right balance between them.
Yes.
And obviously, over-control makes you slow.
Was there any kind of debate within the regiment about
this? Oh, yes, there was, yes. I think at least one... I know one of my close squadron leaders was very much of the opinion that speed mattered more than anything else. And I took it through as much speed as possible, but you must have control. And who's judged right, I don't know.
Which view was shared most widely in the regiment at the time?
Oh, speed, I think.
I see.
Mm. I still think I was right.
That's to be that's to be expected, I suppose, with cavalry regiment. Mm. This period from 37 onwards must have given you a great opportunity to familiarise yourself with the nature of operating in the desert. And I wondered what you found the main problems to be.
Well, living in the desert was one, the economy and the use of water. You see, water had to be very strictly rationed. It was only a gallon a man a day. That was one thing. Making reasonable sort of meals on the little petrol cookers that you had, because all the feeding in the tank squadrons, of course, was done on vehicles. Further back were the lorries and administrative vehicles, but they probably did have a cookhouse of some sort. But living in the desert, people weren't very good at it when they first got out. Some people were a bit afraid of the desert, afraid of getting lost. Occasionally you did lose a tank. It was always found again. I think it was an odd case, probably, when an aeroplane had to be got to look for one. It dropped out, you know, and the wireless didn't work. But as your training got better, that disappeared, that difficulty.
Did you ever get lost yourself?
No. I rather prided myself on being quite a good navigator.
As a result of the, I suppose, more than 3 years training you had in the desert before you became involved in operations in World War II, how well prepared do you think the 7th Hussars were as a mechanized formation by the time war broke out?
We were quite good, I think. We weren't as good as we became later. We were quite good. I mean, quite good, certainly good enough to fight Italians. They wouldn't have cared to take non-Germans in, train Germans.
Yes. What were you not so good at earlier on?
Of course, we only had... You can't talk about gunning because we only had the machine gun. I should say moving, probably. We weren't quite... Wireless control was pretty good. Moving, I should say, was not... moving tactically.
You mean in formations?
Yes, in control formations, yes. Mm. Moving tactically from ground to ground, from position to position. I don't think we were as good as we became later on.
Oh, I see. You mean sort of use of ground and things
like
that?
Yeah, use of ground, yes.
Yes. Wonder why that was. Wonder why that proved to be the biggest...
Well, I don't know. The desert wasn't it wasn't all that easy. You were pretty experienced in the desert. There's no way you could go and where you couldn't go. And there were patches of soft sand where you just couldn't take on. You just got stuck in there or lost the track, which was far worse than a very tank. That probably took 2 hours to put on again.
I was wondering whether it was due primarily to lack of experience with tanks or lack of experience of the desert.
Lack of experience of the desert, I think.
Uh-huh. So you'd have had this...
And what a tank could do in the desert.
Yeah. Good.